Last week, during the response, I made the comment that I hate the phrase creation care. And I mentioned that I would expand upon why I don't like that term this evening. So in my outline, I have that as my prologue, section zero. Why I hate the phrase creation care and other phrases like it, like stewardship of God's creation, so on and so forth. Why I don't like this term, particularly as a theologian, is because of my strong suspicion that it greatly truncates, it greatly contracts what this term creation means in its fullness. That by the term creation or creation care, what we mean in practice is caring for the natural world, meaning the non-human world. It is an attempt to reclaim the term nature from a secular and naturalist and atheist perspective of the world. The word creation only makes sense if there is a creator. And if there is no creator, or at least no creator who is needed to explain the operations of the world, then you can replace the term creation with nature. And this is what occurs during the so-called Enlightenment, that the term nature arises as a term to describe the nature, meaning the operations of the world, apart from God, apart from having to name it as creation. Now, what appears to me to have occurred is in the latter half of the 20th century, for Christians recognizing this removal of God from the world by transforming the description of the world as creation to simply nature, reappropriate the term nature in order to talk about the world as God's creation, but they do so in a way which simply puts the word creation in for what Enlightenment thinkers meant by nature. And that is not all, and is actually quite little of what the term as a Christian theological term means. So let me be even more clear by mentioning that the word nature itself can have at least three different meanings. And sometimes when I use this term, it'll mean one thing or another, and I have that clearly marked, hopefully, on the outline. Nature, etymologically, in its etymological root, where the word comes from, comes from natura in Latin. The Greek equivalent would have been physis, where we get our term physics from. When we use nature in this way, what we're talking about is that set of characteristics which makes something what it is. What is the nature of something? As a human being, my existence is marked by human nature. And so an ancient discussion of natura or physis is an attempt to get at what something is, what characterizes it as distinct from other forms of existence. So, for instance, Christians come to confess Jesus Christ as one divine person who exists with two natures, who brings together a divine nature, because Jesus is divine, whatever it is that makes the Father God, Jesus as the Son of God shares, but also a human nature. Whatever it is that makes us what we are, Jesus shares as well. The term physis and its origin can be seen in the fact that although the mainstream of Christianity confesses Jesus as one person of two natures, there are still monophysite churches, particularly in the Near East. Monophysite, one nature. Churches which confess that, no, we need to think of Christ as having only one nature, a kind of fusion of divinity and humanity, as opposed to having dual natures or two natures. So nature can mean what makes something what it is or its characteristics. Nature comes to mean, particularly in the Enlightenment, as non-artificial, meaning in opposition to or juxtaposition to man-made or human-made or manufactured. So the natural world or the state of nature is the world that exists apart from human interference or human interaction or development. And this is how I believe the term nature is used when it's replaced by the term creation in things like creation care or stewardship of creation, so that when people say, I want to leave the city and enjoy God's good creation, what they mean is they want to get away from the asphalt, they want to get away from the skyscrapers, and they want to go out to the mountains and enjoy the streams and the fresh air. But, as I will hopefully describe later on in my talk, the city with the asphalt and the concrete is just as much God's creation as the mountains and the streams and the clean air. So to refer to only non-artificial things as creation truncates the full meaning of the term creation. And finally, there's this capitalization of nature, which is a personification of the sum of physical forces, properties, interactions, maybe best summarized by the phrase Mother Nature, to speak about nature as a reality in which we're a part of and subject to, but as a reality which is merely, simply, a physical reality. That to speak of nature, and even when we use that as a title of one of our preeminent scientific journals, is to conceive of the world in terms of naturalism, that all that there is are physical forces, and even we as human beings are what we are, our human nature, as well as the natural non-human world, are due to the forces of capital N, Mother Nature. And as I've mentioned, I suspect that Christian usage in the latter half of the 20th century or 21st century to use the word creation now simply means that B version of nature. Nature is non-artificial. But creation includes the so-called artificial. Creation includes culture. So much so that in the book of Revelation, when God speaks of the new heavens and the new earth and what our existence will be like, God speaks of our existence in terms of a city, the New Jerusalem, which is a fantastic metaphor, a fantastic symbol of human cultural achievement, a city. That the world can be expressed in terms of human cultural achievement, the world is God's creation, not simply in terms of a garden, something which seems to be not touched in pristine existence by human hands, although even the term garden itself is not simply a term referring to non-human reality, but to human cultural realities. Gardens don't exist apart from human cultivation. So my thrust for this evening is to attempt to explore theologically what the term creation entails, and to hopefully convey that it expresses far more than simply talking about the non-human world. Well, let me switch into talking about creation as a term, as a claim, is a confession of faith. Or we name the world or cosmos that we live in as creation as a faith claim. We trust that it is true that the world that we live in, that we are a part of, is created by God. That it isn't simply something that exists, but that it is indeed the result of a divine creator. Cosmology can be thought of as the description of the world in which we live. Cosmology, cosmos, world, logos, words about, study of, the principles by which something operates. Cosmology is a description of the world by science or by knowledge, the ways in which we attempt to know things. So when we talk about faith and science, we are talking about two related but distinct epistemological paths, two related but distinct ways of knowing about the world and making claims about the world we live in. I'm going to argue that creation, theologically, from a Christian theological perspective, primarily should be thought of as naming a kind of relation. And when I teach a doctrine of creation class, I repeat and drill this into my students' heads almost every class session, so that by the end of the semester, they've heard me say it about 39 times. that when I'm using the word creation, unless I'm saying differently, what I am naming is a kind of relation. And what kind of relation is that? It's God's relation to the cosmos, the world, and vice versa, how the cosmos relates to God. And let me interject here as to why I very much tonight and in my Doctrine of Creation classes in general will use the word cosmos instead of the words world or universe. I use the word cosmos, which is derived from the Greek term cosmos, because it implies a reality and an integrated whole that is precisely an integrated whole, that the universe or the world in which we exist is not composed of disparate parts, but an integrated whole, such that in the ancient world, human beings as organic systems, as integrated wholes, were thought of as a microcosm of the macrocosm, the larger integrated whole of which they were a part, a very organic understanding of the nature of the world. I don't like using the word world, because in our context, when I say world, many people think simply of the third rock from our local star. They think simply of the planet Earth. So if I was to constantly say that God creates the world, I fear that all too often people are thinking simply of the planet Earth. But by world, when the Bible talks about God creating the world, the Hebrewism that's used there is heavens and earth. God creates the heavens and the earth. And that's an attempt to get across that God creates everything that is not God. I don't like to use the word universe. It would be an adequate term, but the term cosmos goes even further than simply universe or one reality, one world, in this implication that it's an integrated whole. So creation names a kind of relation, and beneath that statement I have this three-word phrase here, God, creation, cosmos, with an arrow pointing one way. This relation is an asymmetric relation. It's not a symmetrical relation. It's an asymmetric relation. God creates the cosmos, not vice versa. That may seem an obvious claim, but in contemporary theological conceptions and in various philosophies, it's not an obvious claim. So, for instance, in some forms of Christian process theology, God has to be understood as existing, again, asymmetrically with creation, but also being affected by and altered and changed by creation, so that God's being in existence is tied to the changes that occur in the creaturely world. That is not a classically Christian or biblical understanding of what is meant by this relation. God creates the world. So in using this term creation, I want to primarily name this as a relation. The early church, in an order to confess that Jesus Christ, as the incarnate Son of God, is eternal along with God and should be worshipped as God, makes a distinction between how the Son of God arises than how the world arises. The world is created by God. But as you probably know from the Nicene Creed, there is an attempt to speak about the Son of God coming from the Father, but not in terms of creation. And so in the Nicene Creed, Christians confess that the Son is begotten, not made, or generated, not created. This is an attempt to describe that the Son of God, the eternal Word of God, the Logos, originates from the Father, but not in the same way that the world originates from God. Because if it was the same way, then we'd have to confess the Son of God as a creature and therefore is not divine, not God. And that leads to all manner of problems for Christians, which is why Arianism has been condemned and why the Church Fathers of the Council of Nicaea tag on to this this biblical word, this biblical referent, that the Son is the only begotten one, monogeneo, only generated one, to try to describe a different kind of relation. So God creates the world. The Father does not create the Son, but two different kinds of relation, and we're focusing on creation. If you want to talk Christology, we'll have to do a different series. As such, if creation is primarily about this relation, then creation, then its primary referent refers to a kind of divine activity. God's creation of the cosmos. If it names this relation, then primarily it's about something God is doing. God creates the cosmos. And therefore, only secondarily can it refer to the result or the effect of that activity. The world is God's creation. So, because of the ambiguity of possessives, of genitives, when we say God's creation, in colloquial language, we're often meaning the secondary meaning. God's creation refers to the world that God has created. But in a technical sense, the term creation primarily means a kind of divine activity. And as you can see, you can only have the secondary sense based on the primary sense. The world can only be God's creation if God is creating the world. And so to speak about God's creation is primarily to talk about a kind of divine activity, and therefore a kind of activity that we have no direct experience of as creatures within the creaturely cosmos. Let me repeat that. Because creation is primarily naming a kind of divine activity, we have no direct experience of what it means to create within the cosmic system. So, yeah, human beings create all kinds of things. They create computers, they create cultural systems, they create other human beings, but not in the way that God creates. We have no direct experience of that. What we do in order to create, to bring into existence new things, is to rearrange what already exists. However, that is not how God creates, and we'll talk about the implications of that in a little bit. Well, what about cosmology? I've done some definitions of creation. What about cosmology? Cosmology names how human beings understand the nature, using that A definition of nature, the nature of the cosmos. What makes the cosmos what it is? What are the interactions and structures and properties of the cosmos? Different cultures and civilizations throughout human history have had and still have different cosmologies, different ways of describing the world in which we live. And now, a biblically based faith confession about the cosmos as creation. So remember my claim that creation is a faith claim, a faith confession. A biblically based faith confession about the cosmos as creation takes different forms in relation to or regarding different cosmologies. A confession of the world as creation is going to have to address different things in relations to different cosmologies, but always attempting to articulate the same fundamental truths. Now, what do I mean by that? In order to get that across, let me take us through three cosmologies. And now I'll use my PowerPoint. I am generally very disdainful of PowerPoint, but sometimes it's extremely handy. Let's see now. This is a picture from a 1913 book, Leaders of Israel by G.L. Robinson, page 2. And it is an attempt to literally portray the ancient Hebrew conception of the universe to illustrate the account of creation in Genesis 1:1 through 2:4a and the flood. That, as you see here, we have a cosmos that has different parts with a specific relation. We have a great deep that has the storehouse and fountains of the deep. And upon these waters, this great deep, rests the earth. And it's got pillars, and perhaps you can't quite see it, but using my newly acquired laser pen, here we go. Here is written Sheol. It is the underworld beneath the earth, the realm of the dead. And these are the foundations of the earth, the pillars of the earth that keep the earth set in the great deep. And now, referencing Genesis 1, we have the heaven or the sky or the firmament. This is the dome that God creates, that God sets into place in order to separate the waters below from the waters above. And it is the heaven. It is that which is above the earth. Well, where does God dwell? God dwells in that which is above the earth, the heaven of heavens, the realm of God. This is not simply a poetic way of describing the world, but contemporary scholars can make a very strong case that ancient Hebrews, as well as other ancient Near Eastern civilizations, truly understood the cosmos to have this structure. And if you think about it, it is a very reasonable and rational way of speaking about what the world must be like. Cosmology is an attempt to speak in a logical logos, a logical and rational fashion about the way the world exists. So, for instance, imagine yourself someplace in the Middle East in a flat plain, particularly in the middle of the night, and you look around, and what you observe is you have a 360-degree view on the horizontal plane, and so maybe it would not be a bad idea to think of the world as a flat disk. If you can look around the world in a 360-degree plane, and particularly at night, if you look at the night sky and the movement of the lights in the sky, it would very much appear that the sky is a dome. And in fact, if you go to a contemporary planetarium in order to see a sky show, then you entering into an architectural space that has a dome on top, because it's the only way that we can have to accurately represent the position of the lights in the skies. So to think of the world as a flat disk or a flat plane that is covered by a dome is a rational, a logical way of making conclusions or deductions about your observations, what you're actually seeing. The sun and the moon move in arcs across the sky, and so it's a curvature. Where does the rain come from? Where does the water spring up from? From the waters above and the waters below. This cosmology is well documented and spread in the ancient Near East, and as I've been trying to emphasize, not irrational, given what could be observed at the time. So I want to make the claim that when we encounter descriptions of the world as having this structure in the Hebrew Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, that what is interesting is not this structure. What is interesting is not that there is a solid dome in which there are lights and that there are waters above and there's waters below. That is not interesting because everyone knows that that's what the world is. If everyone knows that that's what the world is, it's not interesting to talk about that. Why bother writing about it if everyone lives in this world? What is interesting is to confess this world in terms of creation. What is interesting is to make claims about the origin, significance, and meaning of the world in which we live. And so, for instance, one of the surrounding neighbors of the ancient Hebrews, the neighbors whose cosmology and cosmogony, or origin of the cosmos, I know best, the ancient Babylonians, have the well-known Enuma Elish story. Enuma Elish, when on high, or when in the heavens. In order to explain, where does this world that we live in come from? What's its meaning and significance? And very briefly, this is how the ancient Babylonians and the Enuma Elish articulated the fundamental nature and significance, meaning of the world. There were two gods, saltwater goddess, Tiamat, freshwater god, Apsu. And these two gods blended their bodies together, fresh water and salt water. And when you blend bodies together, you get more bodies. And so they are the parents, the mother and the father of the gods. And there are many multiple gods who are multiplied and made by Tiamat and Apsu. And in a move that, unfortunately, as I get older, I all too much relate to, Apsu complains that all of these gods are too noisy and that he can't get any rest or sleep. I have confessed on Facebook that I'm becoming a grumpy old man before my time. And my wife notes that my newly acquired 2000 Lincoln Continental demonstrates that I've become an old man. Anyway, so Apsu, because he doesn't like being disturbed by all these younger gods making so much noise, plans on killing them all. The gods get wind of this, and they kill Apsu. Tiamat is made very, very angry by the destruction of her consort, and she begins to plan a war against the gods, and she breeds all manner of monsters coming out of her saltwater body. The gods elect a champion, Marduk, whom they give all of their power to, because he says, if you want me to be your champion, you have to give me all of your power. So they do so, and he confirms this by creating out of nothing. He says, let there be a garment, and a garment appears. He says, let the garment be gone. The garment's gone away. This is evidence that now he has the power of the gods. And he confronts Tiamat before she destroys the gods. He slays her and bashes her head in and her brains and calls the north wind to take it away. But this is not the end of the story. Marduk then has a, quote, cunning or clever idea. He takes the corpse of this saltwater goddess, and as the text says, like a flatfish, he slices it in half. If you've ever seen a flatfish, or maybe you can think of a piece of flat bread or pita bread, slices it, the body in half, and props up the body with a firmament, a gate, the mansion of heaven, so that half of the body or the half of the saltwater goddess is above and half of the saltwater goddess is now below, and he establishes the so-called mansion of heaven or the vault of heaven, and he assigns various gods to be lights in the heaven. Why? For the marking of time and seasons. And eventually, the gods who have been giving jobs to take care of this construction that Marduk has created begin to complain. It's a lot of hard work to take care of this place. Well, in one version of the Enuma Elish, Marduk then kills the chief complainer. So this tells you what not to do in your jobs. Don't complain or the boss may have your head, quite literally. And out of the chief complainer's body in some versions, out of his own body in other versions, Marduk creates human beings to do the toil, to be the slaves of the gods, so that human beings will have the hard work of maintaining the order of creation and keeping it from going back into chaos instead of the gods. Human beings will have to build shrines in order to honor the gods. So this is a claim about the world in which we all live. Yes, we all know the world has waters above and waters below and has a solid dome that separates the two and that there are lights in the sky that mark the passing of seasons. That's not interesting. What's interesting are the claims about how the world got that way and what the meaning of it all is. And this is not, the Enuma Elish is not a strange account if you really think about it. Two things I want to highlight. First off, is that life is hard. We have lots of technology to help us to maintain our lives and the lives of our loved ones. But even with our modern technology, life is still hard. You have to work hard at it just to keep yourself alive day to day with food and clean water and shelter, so on and so forth. Even more difficult to do so in the ancient Near Eastern world. Why is life so hard? Well, because we're the slaves of the gods. The gods didn't want to do all the hard work of maintaining the order of the world, and so it's up to us. We have to do it. And they're gods and we're not, so that's what we have to do. Secondly, note how central, and I will even use in the very technical sense the term integral, violence is to the creation of the world and the maintenance of its order. Again, this is not a off-the-wall observation or claim. Look all about you. Animals kill other animals for their sustenance. Human beings engage in violence against other human beings, either to take what they want or to prevent others from taking what they want. If you want to maintain the order of the world, you must do so with violence. And even in so-called modern civilized societies, we still arm our police forces ultimately to maintain civil order fundamentally through violence. That's the bottom line. So what the Enuma Elish gives is an explanation as to why life is so hard with the slaves of the gods, and it gives an account of the necessity of violence. And not just violence for the creation of the world, but for the maintenance of the world, the maintenance of the order of creation. It endorses the violence of the state, that the emperor, the king of Babylon, is charged with maintaining order and justice at the point of a sword. Because after all, it is at the point of a spear or arrow, and with a club, and with acts of violence that Marduk created and established the world. The ancient Hebrews have a very different confession about the fundamental nature of the world and the nature of human beings. And I believe Scott Jose described some of this, and I will make brief reference because I need to move on. But in the Hebrew account, in Genesis 1:1 through 2:4a, first off, there's no violence. God speaks, and the world is. There is no need to slay a primordial goddess. There's no need to kill gods. Violence, despite the writer of the text, surely lived in a world full of violence, but makes a confession of faith that violence is not a necessary part of the world. It is not something that is integral to the world. If the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Israel, is the creator of the world, then the world is fundamentally marked by shalom, not violence. And how do you depict this? Well, you depict this by not having any acts of violence whatsoever. And even though you're surrounded by animals that require other animals for their sustenance, you talk about the origin of the world such that the animals simply eat plants. That this is an attempt to declare as a confession of faith that violence is not integral to the world and not an attempt to give an accurate what we would call scientific natural history, can be seen in the fact that the writer has God declaring that the green plants are food for the flying things of the air and the creeping things upon the earth. Well, what about the swimming things upon the sea? What do they eat? Well, the writer can't really imagine how the swimming things upon the sea can come upon the earth to eat the plants, because that's where the plants are. So the writer doesn't address what the swimming things of the sea have to eat. But it's an attempt to articulate it is not necessary for there to be violence, either for the world to exist at all, because there are simply waters that God separates, and no need for violence to maintain that order for sustenance. Animals eat plants, not other animals, at least the flying things of the air and the creeping things upon the earth. Second observation is that human beings are not slaves of the gods. Human beings are given dominion, and they are given dominion over their fellow living creatures, the swimming things upon the sea, the flying things of the air, and the creeping things upon the earth. Note here that all human beings are created in the image of God, and they're given dominion over their fellow living creatures. In the ancient Near Eastern world, often only the ruler or the king or the sovereign or the pharaoh was understood as the image of God on earth. And therefore, they had the right to rule over their fellow human beings. But in this confession about the nature of the world in which we live, human beings don't have the right to rule over other human beings. There's no class of blue bloods. The emperor alone, or the king alone, or the pharaoh alone is not the image of God. But all human beings are the image of God. And we do not rule over each other. We rule over our fellow living creatures. Likewise, there is the emphasis that the lights in the sky are simply lights. They are not divine beings. The waters above and the waters are below are simply waters. They're not the corpse of a goddess. The world is not divine. All manner of things are confessed in faith about the nature of the world of the ancient Hebrew writer. This is what Calvin has to say about Genesis 1:1 in particular, on the fourth day. This passage here, Calvin is addressing, and remember, Calvin's writing in the first half of the 16th century. He is addressing contemporary astronomers, 16th century astronomers, who argue that the Bible is wrong because the Bible says that the moon rules over the night, but even in terms of 16th century astronomy, it can be demonstrated that Saturn must be larger, in fact, much, much larger than the moon. I have an interest in astronomy, and I someday will learn the history of astronomy because it fascinates me that even in the 16th century, human beings could demonstrate that Saturn, which appears very small in the sky, must be many, many, many times the size of the moon, which currently, using modern technology and science, we know to be true. So how would you know that in the 16th century? I don't know, but people are claiming it and demonstrating it to the point where they can prove it. So this is how John Calvin deals with that. It is well to repeat what I have said before, that it is not here philosophically, or in our terms, scientifically. What we call modern natural science arises out of what was originally called natural philosophy, or loving the wisdom, the orderliness of the natural world, discovering the nature of things. That it is not here scientifically discussed how great the sun is in heaven, or how great or how little is the moon, but how much light comes to us from them. For Moses here addresses himself to our senses, that the knowledge of the gifts of God which we enjoy may not glide away. And then he goes on, for as it became a theologian, Moses is making a theological faith claim here. He's not speaking as a philosopher. He's not speaking as a scientist. And again, Calvin holds that Moses wrote the Genesis account, something that contemporary scholars would not concur with. But the important point is that for as it became a theologian, he had respect to us rather than the stars. He's not writing as an astronomer. Nor, in truth, was he ignorant of the fact, because, of course, Moses had to know everything, that the moon had not sufficient brightness to enlighten the earth unless it borrowed from the sun. But he deemed it enough to declare what we may plainly perceive, that the moon is a dispenser of light to us, that God provides for light for us in the dark. Well, let me note here two things. One is that Calvin is emphasizing that the purpose of the text is to make a confession of faith, not to give a what we would call scientifically accurate description of the world. But let me go on. Calvin goes on to make his own kind of scientific pronouncement of the day, and he gets into the debate. That it is, as the astronomers assert, an opaque body, the moon, I allow to be true. Opaque, not clear. While I deny it to be a dark body, something that does not give off light in and of itself. For first, since it is placed above the element of fire, it must of necessity be a fiery body. Hence it follows that it is also luminous. It's logical. If it's a fiery body, it must be luminous, and it must be a fiery body because it's above the element of fire. But seeing that it has not light sufficient to penetrate to us, it borrows what is wanting from the sun. Now, what could Calvin possibly mean by this argument that because the moon is above the element of fire, it must be a fiery body? Well, that's because Calvin lives in this world. Calvin lives in a world that is a globe or a sphere, which is surrounded by multiple translucent but solid, multiple translucent crystalline spheres, which themselves are surrounded by a prime mover, and external to that is the so-called Imperium Heaven, the habitation of God and all of the elect. And again, this is a very rational or logical account of the world, a very rational or logical cosmology, an Aristotelian Ptolemaic cosmology coming out of the philosophy of Aristotle and his description of how the world works, and out of Ptolemy's observations of the stars and their movements. You can see the globe here. Things want to go to where they naturally belong by nature. Rock wants to sink. It wants to sink towards the center of the earth. And water is less dense than rock, and so water sits upon the earth, earth and water being two of the four Aristotelian elements, the other two being air and fire. Air is less dense than water, so you see the clouds. Let me see if my laser pointer can help us out here. Oh, look at that. So you see the clouds that surround the earth, because air is lighter than water, less dense than water. But here is the realm of fire. And we know that fire exists naturally above air because we've all seen candles and bonfires. The flames go up. They go up to their natural place. Rocks go to their natural place, which is toward the bottom. Fire goes to its natural place towards the top. So the realm of fire must naturally be above the realm of air. And the moon exists in the sphere, this crystalline sphere which revolves above the realm of fire. So it's the lunary and superlunary world, and the lunary and sublunary world that makes up the cosmos. The lunary and superlunary world is made up of the fifth element, the quintessence, this reality which is even less dense than fire. So it's this heavenly fire, the celestial fire. And why are there different spheres? Because if you look in the light sky, most of the lights all move in the same pattern with each other, in a fixed pattern, the so-called fixed stars. But there are some stars that don't go in this pattern. They move in a different circuit, and they are called wandering stars, or in the Greek, planetos. And so if there are lights in the sky which don't move along with the fixed lights, they must be in their own spheres. And how do we know which sphere they're in? Well, based on how fast they take to get back to the same position during their orbits. So if you were to look at this diagram, you would see that the first sphere is the lunar sphere because it takes only 29 days for the moon to make its orbit around the Earth. Mercury is the next sphere because it takes the next amount of time, then Venus, then the Sun, then Mars, then Jupiter, then Saturn. And then the fixed stars take 36,000 years to go around the Earth. So from our perspective, the so-called fixed stars would take that long to go around. And around all of this is the prime mover, primo mobile, which revolves every 24 hours. Now, an Aristotelian description of the world, the reason why everything has motion, everything has change, everything has flux, why acorns transform into oak trees, why people grow old, why things are in one position and the next, is ultimately due to the movement of the prime mover. The prime mover moves, then all the spheres move, and then all manner of change and flux and things happen in the mundane or sublunary world. It is the prime mover who governs all things in this cosmological system. But Calvin makes a confession of faith, a description of the world, a confession about who is the ultimate governor, who is actually sovereign. The world is not governed by an unthinking prime mover. The world is governed by the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The world is governed by the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, this is not the cosmology that I take to accurately describe the world. This is not the cosmology that I take to accurately describe the world. As someone living in the early 21st century, I take this to be a cosmology which more accurately, not precisely, modern science is strong precisely because it's revisable, but so-called contemporary Big Bang cosmology is an attempt, given what we observe about the world, same way as in ancient Near Eastern or Aristotelian Ptolemaic cosmology, given what we observe about the world, what is the best explanation for how the world is organized, what its properties are, what its structures? And what this is an attempt to do, comes from NASA, is to give a pictorial diagram of the 13.7 billion year history of the cosmos, and at different stages, different phases, how the cosmos evolves and changes over time. And it is depicting the cosmos in both terms of space and time because of the recognition that space and time are part of the same reality, not two radically separate realities. And we live at the outer edge here at this point in time. We live in a cosmos filled with billions of stars that exist in billions of galaxies. And we are small bits of dust populating a very tiny rock around a very ordinary star. How to confess creation given this cosmology is the perennial, the always, the ongoing task of those who maintain the biblical faith that the world doesn't simply exist the way it is. The world does not exist except for the fact that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, has created it. Well, if you flip over your sheets, I'm only going to spend 6 minutes talking about all this. What a confession of creation entails. What is meant when Christians and those of biblical faith confess the world is created? Much more than saying that God made birds and trees and flowers and bees. A confession that the world exists in a relation with God that we term creation means that reality is fundamentally divided into two vastly differing kinds of existence, divine existence and creaturely existence. The existence that God has and enjoys, and the existence that created creatures have and enjoy, and the created cosmos as a whole. And these are some characteristics which distinguish this kind of existence. Divine existence is uncreated. It has no origin. The term aseity means from itself. God does not exist because anyone created God. When someone such as Richard Dawkins asks, if God created the world, who created God? My response as a theologian is, you are misusing the term God. The term God, at least in Judeo-Christian usage, specifically means that being which possesses aseity, that being who is uncreated. So to ask if God has a creator means you do not understand what the term means when we say God. Divine existence is necessary. God cannot not exist. God's existence is independent, does not depend on anything else, is infinite, and cannot be measured or bound. In terms of time, God is infinite, is eternal, not marked by time. In terms of space, God is not marked by space. God is immense, not measurable, because time and space are created by God. God is simple. God does not have parts. When you read in the Belgic Confession, the first article, one of the first things, characteristics of God that is stated is that God exists as a spiritual, simple being. Simple means does not have parts. Perhaps you engineers out there, you physicists recall what a simple machine is. It is a machine that has only one part. Complex machines are made of multiple parts. The created cosmos is marked by the fact that it is created, that it is contingent. It does not have to exist, nor does it have to exist the way it exists. It is marked by dependency upon God and marked as existing interdependently, meaning that creatures within the cosmos depend upon each other. I depend on air. I depend on other creatures for food. I depend on the sun. I depend upon my parents to come into existence. We're interdependent. But ultimately, the cosmos and all that is in it is dependent upon God. It's finite. It's limited. The cosmos as a whole is finite and creatures within it. It's marked by time. It's measurable, marked by space, and it has parts. Creation means that the world is not God and God is not the world. A biblical confession of creation denies pantheism or semi-divine beings. In various ancient systems, the world is not created by a divine being, but a semi-divine being that's sort of half God, half creature that bridges the two. The cosmos is dependent upon God, but it has its own causal structural integrity. If the world really is not God, if it's a distinct reality to God, then it has its own integrity. It's not an extension of God, but has its own form of reality that God respects. To speak about God's ways of acting and creatures' ways of acting, theologians have made a distinction between so-called primary causality and secondary causality. The ways in which God brings about God's will in the world that God creates is radically, to the root, different than the ways in which we bring about our wills or the ways in which creatures affect each other. God is not a creature among other creatures. To accomplish what God wants, God does not have to engage in a tug of war with creatures. All too often we have a picture of God as a really powerful being among other beings, and that God will order the cosmos to God's will in the ways that a really huge Superman might. But to illustrate the distinction between primary and secondary causality, I like to refer to fictional novels. And as I tell my students in a Doctrine of Creation class, J.K. Rowling does not exist in the same way that Harry Potter or Hogwarts does. The way that she accomplishes what she wants in that world is very different than the way that Harry or Hermione or Voldemort accomplish what they want to accomplish. That God is creator means God is free to create or not to create. The world is contingent, doesn't have to exist, doesn't have to exist the way it exists. As I tell my students, God could have created the cosmos that was just entirely fudge. But apparently God didn't want to do that. Why not, I don't know, because that's what I might have done. But a few more things before I finish in about 2 or 3 minutes. This relation means that God is the origin of the cosmos, not only in terms of originating or starting the cosmos, but of being the continuous and constant source of the cosmos' existence. We think often in terms of creation as God starting something and then backing off, but that is not a Christian or biblical confession of creation. We are constantly and continuously upheld in existence by God's creative activity. A doctrine of creation means that God is fundamentally and ultimately sovereign over the created cosmos. J.K. Rowling is the one who's telling the story. She is the one who is ultimately sovereign. God is the one who speaks and maintains the cosmos in existence and is therefore sovereign. Christians confess that the world does not presently exist or operate the way God fully intends. We must speak of the world somehow as fallen. And importantly for Christians, we must confess that the world is created by a triune creator, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. If you were to explore how to think about creation in terms of God's Trinitarian activity, we would be able to discuss a variety of depths of how to think about the term, and perhaps we will in our conversation. Finally, let me conclude by saying that if we're going to confess that this world is God's creation. And that this world, which is marked by the evolution or the change of life over time, by processes we call Darwinian or neo-Darwinian, then our confession of this world, this cosmos, as creation, must address the seeming creation, the seeming freedom of the cosmos to explore a variety of possibilities through such natural processes, must address the nature of suffering and death in nature, must address the nature of the fall of humanity and human sinfulness, and must address the so-called subjugation of all creation to futility, to vanity, to entropy, to death, to dissolution, as described in Romans 8, 18 through 25, and also must be open to insights implied by the resultant creation, by the cosmos itself, as we know it to be for understanding God's creative activity.
Thank you, Brian, for that wonderful talk. And I'm looking at the time, and I guess I'm going to limit my response to just one item, and that was the visual pictures here of the ancient Near East cosmology and then the Western medieval cosmology. And looking at those and thinking, you know, that's a reasonable way for people to have thought about the world around them and try to make sense of the world around them. And especially when you think about the solid dome with the firmament and the waters below and above. And then looking at John Calvin's time when he was writing. And for me, it's one of the things that says, you know, you've got to look at the first chapters of Genesis and understand that the people for whom it was written at that time would have had a picture that was like that. And so their understanding, and when we're reading about what God has done and that description, are so influenced by it. The same thing with John Calvin. He's also influenced by it. And so when we're reading Genesis, it's one of the things that I take to it is that in order to understand it properly, I can't just think, I just got to read it simply. But in fact, I need to really rely on the scholars who in theology who are helping us to understand what was meant by it, because it's not simply just read what the text says and just take it for face value. That's not getting at what is trying to be communicated about the relationship between God and his creation. So that was really helpful as I've been thinking about interpreting Genesis. So thank you.
Questions?
I am involved with younger people who are teaching Sunday school and catechism to kids in kindergarten and first, second, third, fourth grade. And they are concerned and asking me, how should I teach the creation story? And I don't have an answer, and maybe that's too big a subject now, but maybe one of you might have some material that I could refer to, because I wouldn't know how to teach those children either.
I haven't been on the website, and I don't have access to the web right now, but I suspect that the CRC NA, the Christian Reformed Church of North America, on their website, would probably have a list of either CRC-published resources or resources from other Reformed denominations to address that very question of materials which convey to young children in ways they can understand what it means for God to create the world using the biblical text. So for me, when in doubt, I check the Internet. So perhaps the, crcna.org, if you access that website, perhaps there are references to useful materials. It's a difficult thing to talk about and describe and to convey, not just for children, but for adults, what is meant by God creates the world and what is being confessed about the nature of the world in not just Genesis 1:1 through 2:4a, or Genesis second chapter, or in Proverbs 8, or in John when John says that the world was created through the Word. it's not something that readily we get our minds around, in part because we are 20th century and 21st century Westerners who have a very different understanding of the world than those who wrote and would have been the original audiences for the Bible.
Okay, I have a question here. Is a miracle a competitive or a competitor with secondary causality?
This is one of the strengths of speaking in terms of primary and secondary causality. Miracles would not be a competitor with secondary causes because the term primary causality means that all structures and all causal relations within the cosmos are primarily due to God's creative activity. And so if something occurs within the creaturely cosmos that is not how we usually encounter things interacting with each other, then it is not a violation of secondary causes, but is God as primary cause bringing causality, bringing creatures into relation in a distinct way. So God is not violating secondary causing. He's not competing with secondary causality by bringing what we would call a miracle about. It may seem miraculous for an event to occur within a story that an author writes, but because the author is the primary cause of all things that happens in that story, it's not a violation of how the characters and events occur within the story. It's a useful, if limited, analogy.
Other questions?
Augustine seemed to get it, at least, you know, in a certain way. Calvin seemed to get it, at least in a certain way. Somewhere along the line, somebody or everybody dropped the ball. I go through these sessions feeling like grossly misled in my upbringing, not blaming my parents, but somebody dropped the ball, because what we're talking about here, which seems so sensible and seems to be rooted in tradition, it was nowhere to be found and isn't found in preaching from pulpits or in Sunday school flannel graph things or in the thing for kids in the banner, the double spread just recently perpetuating things that we have been debunking. So where do we go from here? I mean, if it matters, we're all here, so it must matter. If it matters, what are we going to do about it? That I leave here troubled every week about that. It's like we're talking about it, but are we talking about it toward an end, towards a purpose?
Brian, I want to answer for you.
Okay.
No.
Inside joke.
I'm Dan Harlow, one of the consultants in this project. You know, this is a Templeton Foundation-funded grant, and I wrote the proposal for it. One of the purposes of this program, which is called Scientists in Congregations, is not only to educate lay people, and boy, I got an education tonight from Brian, and even a greater one from Arlene, but part of the grant money is going to go for the development of age-appropriate curricula for kids in primary school, middle, secondary school, adults. Because you can't lay cosmologies on 6 or 7 year olds. But by the time kids are in the 7th and 8th grade, or 6th and 7th grade, they are getting questions, right? So one thing that's going to happen in this series, by the time it ends next year, or a year and a half from now, is COS is going to develop teaching resources and make them available to other churches. They're going to become a permanent part of a website, maybe a subset of our church website, right? I've talked to teachers at Grand Rapids Christian High and at the school where my kids go to, Evergreen Christian School. And these are college graduates. Many of them went to Calvin's. We know about the age of the earth, the age of the universe. We know that Genesis is stating key theological truths while taking for granted an ancient cosmology. We know that, but we're afraid to teach this in high school or middle school or anything because parents will get mad at us. And why will parents get mad at us? Because as you started out with your observation, we've grown up and we didn't hear this growing up in Sunday school or church. In the courses I teach at Calvin College to freshman, sophomore students, many of them, after we study the book of Genesis, and they see that we want to understand what the Lord is trying to teach us and how what we get out of it might, though, be different from what the ancient Israelites got out of it. I've had young men and young women, 18, 19-year-olds, say, you know, I feel betrayed. I see this. I get it. The science, the biblical studies, the theology. This makes perfect sense, and it's liberating in a way. It's an eye-opener. But I feel like my mom and dad and my youth group leader and my pastor and my Sunday school teacher and my high school biology or Bible teacher, they've all let me down. And I try to exonerate all of those people.
Good.
Yes. Yeah. And saying, look, nobody has let anybody down. None of us have let anybody down in the sense of we've got to assign blame, right? It's just that there is a time to study. There are different levels of study. You can dive in only so deep when you're at various ages. We talk about faith formation, faith development, cognitive development. Well, you know, there's a knowledge curve here. There's a learning curve. And so if pastors and Christian educators could somehow partner with educators in our Christian schools by using resources of the sort we hope will come out of this whole series, then we'll make one small step for man and one giant leap for Christian kind. I mean, right? So anyway.
And there are, in this program, 30 churches, and they're all going to put it on the web. So, I mean, it is out there. Okay, another question.
Brian, the Hebrews critiqued the dominant cosmologies. We saw in Calvin also a kind of engagement, a critique of that late medieval cosmologies. So going back, because you just sort of whipped through it, said 6 points, we got to talk about them. Could you offer us a few words of critique on our, you know, where you see this Christian thinking about creation as a critique within the context of our Darwinian cosmologies?
Sure. My claim is that what I still have left on the board here is the world in which we live, and that part of the world in which we live involves life developing on this particular planet through Darwinian and neo-Darwinian forces. And that is simply a cosmology. That's simply a description, a knowledge claim about what is. What a doctrine of creation needs to do is counter interpretations of the meaning and significance of what we observe or think or claim the world to be. Let me give you a quick example. When I was in residence at Duke, I was in a philosophy of biology class for freshmen. I was team taught by a biologist and a philosopher of science, and the philosopher of science got up the second day of class and said, science has already answered the question as to whether or not there is a God or any meaning to life, and the answer to both is no. Let's move on. Now, even as a graduate student, and to this day I regret not having the moxie to call a professor on this, even as a graduate student, I recognized that this person, particularly as a philosopher, knew better. Particularly as a philosopher of science, you know that science can't make such claims. that that is beyond the purview of what science can do. What this person seemed to be saying is, what science tells us is that a God who tinkers and arranges all things just so without any capacity to explain that through natural causality or secondary causality, or some sort of supernatural being that we can look to for moral guidance based on moral principles, or that there is an afterlife, none of these things are seemingly established by what we know about the world. That seems to be what the person was saying. And so scientists and popular understanders of science can give a so-called naturalistic read of the world in which we live. That the world in which we live is only explainable in terms of natural forces, natural relations, and anything that we think of as ultimate meaning or significance is purely a human construct, purely what we do as animals which assign meaning to things. Well, a Christian doctrine of creation must make claims, if it is to be faithfully Christian, which deny these claims, which are philosophical claims, not scientific claims. And indeed, from a Christian philosophical and theological perspective, there is no scientific reason to claim that the world is solely governed by natural forces. There is no scientific reason to claim that there can be no meaning or is no meaning in life. That the world is dependent upon God. And even, as some contemporary cosmologists attempt to do, even if the cosmos is part of a multiverse, an explanation as to why this particular universe is hospitable to life can be simply described because it's part of a whole infinite series of multiverses, or that this universe is part of a series of expanding and collapsing and expanding and collapsing infinite series of universes that has no actual beginning. Even if that were the case, as is claimed by Carl Sagan in the opening preface to A Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking, he seems to say that if the universe has no beginning or end, that therefore there's no need for a creator. Even if that is the case, that does not deny the world is creation. Thomas Aquinas argued that back in the 13th century, that it is a doctrine of faith for him that the world has a beginning, but even if the Aristotelians are correct in their claim that the universe has no beginning or end, is eternal, that does not mean that the universe is necessary or not dependent. Even in a universe which has no beginning is contingent upon a creator and is dependent upon a creator. Even if we have our own integrity as creatures and that the physical operations of the world are such that genetic material can be altered by mutagens, whether radiation or chemicals, and that life can find different pathways of existing, that does not deny that God is the sovereign who, by God's word and spirit, maybe that's another night to talk about creation by word and spirit, brings about the diversity, direction, and conclusion to the cosmos that God intends. So there are a whole variety of tasks for Christian theologians to engage in to confess creation in this world, just as John Calvin confessed creation in his world and the writer of Genesis confessed creation in his or her world.
You spoke about how the Hebrew cosmology had to rebut this claim of integral violence, mm-hmm. that it was a necessary part of life. Given that we now believe evolution necessarily is life at another's expense. Mm-hmm. In point 3b, you talk about how we need to address the nature of this suffering. Uh-huh. Not how should everyone address it, but how do you address this idea of someone else loses?
And this came up last week as well. Eventually, I'm going to spend, well, not eventually because I'm in the midst of it right now, I'm going to be spending my whole career trying to be a theologian confessing creation, given this world, given
what we describe in biology as evolution. One of the things that I want to pursue as a theologian to think through is creation as a Trinitarian activity. That God creates the world through God's Word and by God's Spirit, and what that means. Yes, Christianity argues that death is an enemy and must be understood as such. And yes, we look toward the New Jerusalem, a city in which there will be no more suffering, pain, or death, or crying, for the former things have passed away. But if I'm going to think about the world as created through the Word of God, created through the Lamb who is slain before the foundation of the world, created through a Word that gives one's life on behalf of others, if the world is created through that logic, created through that Word, then I need to think about how is it that God makes use of suffering and death to be creative, and that in a Trinitarian account of creation and thinking through what it means that Jesus of Nazareth incarnates the Word of God and what it means for the world to be created through this Word, then I need to, as a theologian, think about what is the place of suffering in God's creative activity.
Okay, we have room for one more question.
Sort of building on that question, he took one of the particular components. He did a nice job of laying out what a cosmologically Darwinian confession ought to contain. And I think you've done a pretty decent job of theologically thinking, teaching us how to think about it. From a biological perspective, how close are we to answering the questions posed by those five, and is that something that biology can answer? In terms of how the fall happened, if we don't believe in a God of the gaps, and we don't believe that there was some sort of divine intervention that somehow created, you know, a certain stab, will biology ever be able to show us the particular points at which these kinds of events may have happened, how the fall may have come into effect? Is that a biological issue, or is that strictly theology?
Well, I guess I would say that I think it's a theological issue. I think we could probably see some of the effects of it, but I think it's a theological issue. I think it's a relationship issue between us and God.
When I put on 3E, must be open to insights implied about the resultant creation as we know it to be for understanding God's creative activity. When we talk about the fall of humanity or the nature of sin, then we have to be open to thinking about that given the world we live in, given the world that the ancient Hebrews lived in, one can speak about the fall of humanity in terms of a garden, in terms of forbidden fruit, in terms of a tree that gives knowledge of good and evil, in terms of a tree of life that we're denied access to. How we talk about the fall, human sinfulness, given the cosmos that we live in, will look different and necessarily looks different. And that is a task that the church has for today. The church always has the task of asking, have we heard from God correctly? Are we responding to God properly? And how do we talk about this conversation that God is having with God's creation? That is an ongoing, ever-lasting task that the people of God will have until the earth is full of the knowledge of God and we know even as we are known.
Would you join me in thanking?